Hello, Hyrule. Welcome back to the premier Legend of Zelda Travelogue podcast. We are your tour guides. My name is Pete.
And my name's Chris.
So, Chris, I actually wanted to point something out really quick about the last episode.
Uh-oh. I wonder if it's because I have a correction in my head for the last episode.
You do?
I wonder if it's the same thing that you're about to point out.
Well, I don't know if it would count as a correction, but the boss of the Cave of Flames, the Glerok, I think I said something during that recording, something to the tune of like, I've never heard of one before. I can't remember from any games. Turns out it's actually a boss from the very first game on the NES, Chris.
Yeah, I was listening to another Zelda podcast.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they mentioned it, and it was after we had recorded, like, literally that episode.
Woof.
And I was just like, oops.
Yeah, no, I mean, when you look at it, though, it's almost like a completely different boss, though. Like, on the NES, it's like a multi-headed Hydra, and whenever you hurt it enough, or you hurt one of the heads enough, the head will fly around and attack you.
Mm-hmm.
It's like some kind of nightmare Hydra. But so I'm gonna count it as this is, like, a separate monster, yeah?
Yeah, but, I mean, we all kind of know the truth. A few other... Hey, you know what? You opened up the correction corner.
Uh-oh.
We might as well knock a few other ones out while we're here.
Are we going to settle? We're really going to settle on that definition, huh?
Well, while I start addressing our past wrongs, you could think of a better name for this. In the last episode, we talk about Tingle and his brothers who are in this game.
Yes.
And then after the first time we mention his brothers, we refer to them as cousins from that point on. I think I was speaking about cousins at an earlier point in the episode, and then they just got all switched up in my head.
So they're all definitely brothers?
Definitely brothers.
Is that also true in Wind Waker?
I do not know. Are all of the same ones in Wind Waker?
I'm not sure if they're exactly the same. They might be the same colors. They might have different names. I'm not sure. But I think it's the same number of brothers or cousins, though.
Interesting. I only played enough Wind Waker to meet Tingle, embarrassingly, so I'm very excited to get to Wind Waker.
That's going to be an interesting season.
I cannot wait for that. And Twilight Princess. I can't wait to go deep on those two, really. And a few other things that we kind of mentioned that I've been thinking about bringing back up at later points. Might as well get them out now.
Okay.
Breath of the Wild locations that are related to the Minish Cap.
Oh, okay. Right on.
I think during the Mount Krennel episode, we mentioned that Mount Krennel is a location in Breath of the Wild. That is true.
It's Krennel something, though. I don't know if it's Mount Krennel. The same thing is true for Trilby, which I think Trilby Highlands got two different locations in Breath of the Wild.
Yes. Yeah, there's also Veiled Falls.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Minish Cap has a Veil Falls. Breath of the Wild has a Veiled Falls.
Nice.
And there are two locations, one called Minchi Woods.
Oh.
And one right nearby called Pico Pond.
Okay.
How good is that?
Breath of the Wild is so full of references that it... Like, they did a great job with that.
I agree. I love seeing that. Especially, like, I can't wait till we get to Breath of the Wild now, because at that point...
In 10 years,
we're going to have all of this knowledge that we're going to be bringing to it, and it's just a game that loves the franchise so much. So.
Yeah, I mean, and possibly by then, Breath of the Wild 2 will be out, so we'll have a lot more reference.
Oh, man, this is going to be never-ending, huh?
All right, Chris, so before we get started, do you want to drop a recap on us real quick?
I do. So last episode, we learned the power of the Four Sword firsthand when we entered the Elemental Sanctuary, infused the elements, and almost got beheaded by a tutorializing tablet from the heavens.
Did we?
Yes.
I'm not sure if we were in any danger of that.
I think we were. And in doing so, we learned how to clone ourselves before a pretty sizable lore dump, which taught us about the history between the Minish Ezlo and his angsty young apprentice, Vati. We also met Tingle.
Dude... we also dropped a lot of theories last time.
Every episode of this season has been jam-packed with theories. We keep saying, hey, this episode's gonna be short, and then we make theories off of nothing. We make theories off of rocks that are outside of caves.
Oh, Chris.
We make theories off of everything.
Chris,
it's been so much fun.
If you're about to pin our long run times on theories and not like the one-to-one recapping of plot and such, then, like, I got some bad news for you.
I think it's a little bit of both.
But yeah, so this episode, we are going to shapeshift this tour guide into a tour boat as we're going to be heading into the western swamps of the Castor Wilds.
Oh, nice.
Except we're not doing that yet, Chris.
Uh-oh. What happened?
Well, here's the thing. When you first make your way towards Castor Wilds, you're going to see at least one or two signs that mention you should be bringing your Pegasus boots with you. Which, if you know what those are in the Zelda series, it's a fairly common item that, you know, makes you run real good.
But Pete, I don't got time to read signs. I'm going to just dash right into that Castor Wilds.
That's great, because you actually have to do that. It turns out, I mean, my recollection on this could be wrong, and also the wikis that I read could be wrong. But I'm pretty sure that in order to properly continue the plot, you actually have to enter Castor Wilds and sink in the swamp before you can proceed.
Yeah, that triggers some dialogue from Ezlo talking about how we can't get through the way things are right now.
I'm not sure. Yeah, but like you actually have to sink, which is the strangest thing to me. I can't think of any other time in a game where, in a Zelda game, where you have to like die.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like something that might happen and just no specific occurrences are coming to mind, but I can't think of any off the top of my head either.
In any case, it takes 2 seconds. Then you get the prompt from Ezlo to head back to town to the shoemaker because we're going to need some specialty boots.
Oh, and that brings us to this episode's Hyrule business highlight.
At the top!
Right at the top. Might as well get it done now because the whole rest of the episode requires...
Yeah, kind of hinges on this guy, huh?
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about Rem's shoe shop. Rem? You call him Rem, right?
Rem is how I would refer to that. How else would you pronounce R-E-M?
R-E-M.
Oh, so you think he uses his initials?
No. You see that and I just think of the band, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, either it's going to be Rem or it's going to be Reem, which I don't think we want to call this guy that.
No, I don't think so. So anyway, we go back to Hyrule Town and we enter the shoe store owned by Reem. It's the shop with the giant shoe on it, very fittingly.
So you enter in here, you find this guy asleep at his counter.
I think you walk in and you see him falling asleep. You enter just in time. What kind of a businessman falls asleep as a customer enters the door?
Me.
Fair enough.
When I used to do retail a long time ago, I used to work at FYE, Chris, which is, you know, like a used music and movie store.
I know exactly what it is. I used to work at one too, and we just really showed our age there.
Yeah, they all kind of went the way of the dinosaur, huh?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I am someone who, if you know me well enough, have had rings under my eyes for the majority of my adult life. So if I were given the opportunity to sit down during work, pretty much the entire stock of the store would have been stolen.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. I get it. The retail can be long, boring shifts. Retail could be very difficult. I mean, I guess it depends on where you work on.
It's a hot nightmare, Chris.
Yeah, yeah. I've definitely done my share of retail jobs.
Mad respect to anybody who's doing the retail game right now.
So we enter this shop. The one person in here is fast asleep, but we can shrink down and talk to some Minish here.
Yeah, up on the counter where he's supposed to be making his boots.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so. So there's a big blue pot here in the room that you have to flip in order to turn small, first off.
Flip wizard.
And there's a small little notch dug into the side of the counter, presumably made by Minish, sort of like a ladder that you can climb up to the top.
Which, like, why?
I guess so they can get to work? That's their commute, Chris.
Right. But does no one see?
I get that's a good point. Like, do their workings follow the same rules as themselves? Like, do you not notice it if you don't believe in Minish?
I don't know.
But anyway, up here you find, I think, three different town Minish, I guess we'll call them, who wear like knitted caps and such. We described them previously. They're much more, you know, metropolitan looking little guys. Very cute.
They are. And they're standing on top of some shoe blueprints, some shoe prints.
Which I guess Rem needs, or is that for them?
I would imagine it's for Rem, because like the pictures are like the size of Rem's hand. So it's not like it's going going unseen, unless right. it's like the latter.
Well, I mean, is because this guy is a trained professional shoemaker, yes?
I think his credentials could be called into question, because once we talk to these Minish, we learn that they are the ones who actually are building the shoes for Rem, but they need Rem to put the quote-unquote finishing touches on
right.
them.
Right, which are what exactly?
He like hammers the bottom of them once.
Something that only he can do, right? It must be that, right?
I guess, but like, how do you get that far? Like in either direction, how does this happen? Like, how does Rem...
I mean, never mind the fact that these are magic boots, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, we learn that Rem just thinks he's super good at doing this stuff in his sleep, which, like, okay, dude. I don't know. I don't know how Minish are... I guess whatever makes Pegasus boots Pegasus, like, whatever makes them have that run ability, maybe that's the finishing touches, but you would think that the Minish would have the magic touch, not Rem.
Maybe they do. Maybe, I mean, because since Rem thinks he makes the boots entirely in his sleep, maybe he also thinks he's a magic man who can make magic boots that let you run on swamp water.
I guess so. Anyway, they also tell us in order to wake Rem up, we need to get an item from Syrup's house in the Minish Woods. Truly a buck wild thing to tell another living creature to do.
I guess they, if they know the woods, they know the occupants of Minish Woods, right? So it's not that odd of a direction.
Yeah, I guess. But like to say that you need to work with, like they are a business telling you you need to go to another business and purchase a thing.
Oh yeah. What do they gain from this exactly?
So the idea of these, you know, creatures helping someone at their shop, like as soon as we saw this happening, I thought, oh, this is something, right? This is an established thing.
Yeah. It's the classic fairy cobbler story. You know, there's a million iterations of it. I've been hearing it since kindergarten.
Oh, okay. Yeah. When I looked it up, I was able to trace it to the Brothers Grimm tale, The Elves and the Shoemaker.
Yeah,
which
exactly.
Seemed pretty fitting. So yeah, we can go find Syrup the Witch. Syrup the Witch is a recurring character, right?
Yeah, pretty frequent.
She's in a lot of the 2D games.
Yeah, most of the time when you find Syrup in the games, she's brewing a pot of something, and you usually have to bring her a mushroom of some sort in order to make a potion that does something, or like magic powder.
Yeah, so you want to talk about weird businesses. We enter Syrup shop.
Well, hang on. There's quite a few steps. I'll gloss over it for you. But there's quite a few steps in order to get over to Syrup Shop. Firstly, you got to make your way down to Lon Lon Ranch. You wouldn't think so. But once you're in there, you make your way out the back door, which will lead you to the cow fields who, by the way, when you are small, you can actually speak to the cows around here.
You could speak to a lot of animals in this game when you're small.
It was around this point that I started to realize that, actually. Because why is it? Because can all Minish just speak to all animals? Or is this a Jabbernut situation?
I mean, there are still some animals that are hostile to you and won't speak to you. Like there's specifically a dog in Hyrule Town that'll be like, listen, hey, hi, I'm a dog, I'm very cute. Other dogs might attack you, so you know, just keep it cool.
I can't think of a single dog that has attacked me in this game. It's mostly been cats.
Am I thinking of a cat?
Might be.
I'm thinking of a cat.
But anyway, you have to go this way through Lon Lon Ranch in order to get to like this valley behind it. It's a very small area that's got some pachi holes that you can shoot the canapachi into to...
Shoot the canapachi into the hole.
And you do a flip to get up onto some higher ground in this valley. Then you ride a couple different tornadoes with Ezlo as a parachute. That'll lead you from one cliff to another and then across a little pond. That will lead you to the exit you need to get to Syrup Shop.
There you go. In any case,
in Minish Woods, you find Syrup Shop, which looks like kind of like a Smurf house, but like a big Smurf house.
Which is just a house.
Not exactly. If you look at it, it looks like it was built out of a tree trunk, but like then they slapped a mushroom roof on it. But then you get inside there, Syrup's brewing, you know, her pot of something, and you can buy the wake-up shroom that you need for 60 rupees.
So this is like kind of where it becomes muddy to me, like... Is this Syrup's house or is this Syrup's shop? Because it's like, if this is her house, that's fine. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, live how you want to live. Live your best life. I don't care. But if this is Syrup's shop, it's a big circular room with her cauldron and one mushroom, which you're about to buy.
Who's to say? It could be a hot item.
I mean, clearly it is, because you have narcoleptic shopkeepers in Hyrule Town who can only wake up with the smell of mushrooms. Syrup will tell us, one whiff and you'll be wide awake. That's why it's called a wake-up mushroom. I don't know that one whiff is a better thing. I have a note here that says, a person that sells only one thing and it's this is called a drug dealer. And then I have another note underneath it that says, or maybe a barista.
Oh yeah, okay. That's a little kinder to this old lady in the woods.
I mean, if you're just whiffing something and it's giving you energy though.
Is it energy or is it just waking you up? Because like smelling salts are a thing.
Yeah, I guess.
Pretty sure not hearing about any police raids on smelling salts. Also, it could just smell really bad.
You're not hearing any police raids in Hyrule Town because all of the guards in Hyrule Town are too busy doing stuff that are absolutely irrelevant to anything.
Yeah, too busy asking kids to do somersaults and stuff. Yeah,
exactly. And now they're all chasing themselves looking for a light source. Come on.
No, that I'm convinced they know what the Triforce is. They're just keeping busy so they don't die.
We're gonna go back to Rem. We talk to him. Link shoves the mushroom in his face and he has a line of dialogue here. He says, hey, thanks. I'm sure you are here because you want shoes. The one thing here. Here are some shoes. It's like how in Pokemon games you always end up with a bike voucher right where there's a bike shop. And it's like, sure. Oh, cool, one of those, please.
So is it reasonable to assume now that Pegasus boots are worth a measly 60 rupees?
I guess in like a roundabout way.
These are important items. Like,
but when you talk about the value of Pegasus boots to Rem, he just gave these to you. It's not like you're directly paying 60 rupees for them.
I mean, he's giving it to you for the mushroom, though.
No, he's giving it because you did a favor for him and you woke him up.
Yeah.
He basically says, you did me a favor. I mean, I guess it could be seen as... one whiff of a mushroom is worth...
It's a heck of a favor. If the favor is just to wake him up from sleeping at work, then, like, he gives you free stock, he must, like, be at risk of losing his job. Like, his manager is going to come in and scream at him.
Also, it's totally wild that, like, he's not at all concerned with the fact that he needs a mushroom to wake him up.
Maybe that's why there was only one in stock.
I'm a boy with a sword and bombs, and you're telling me the one thing that could wake this dude up is a mushroom by his nose?
Oh, that's a good point. If you can't wake up from a bomb blast nearby, then you got some issues.
Absolutely. Anyway, he has one last line of dialogue after giving you the boots saying, oh, I need to hurry up and get working on that special order. The king asked me to make some special shoes for Princess Zelda, which, like, I don't know. That doesn't really actually lead to anything.
No, not at all. I mean, it's just in a little detail. Like,
yeah.
I don't think that we're going to have resolution on that plot thread.
It would be kind of cool to see Princess Zelda just Pegasus booting around if, like, in the final boss fight, she was like freed from stone and she was just Pegasus booting like around as you fought the final boss.
This would be the one to do it too, right? Because like this is like the more like energetic Zelda that we've had.
Mm-hmm. But spoilers, they don't do that.
Yeah, no. Surprise. Rem does not show up in the final battle to give Zelda shoes.
Do you want to talk about the Pegasus boots at all?
They are one of my favorite Zelda items, actually.
They're great.
Because yes, you run fast. It helps you avoid things and get to certain stuff in a necessary time limit, but also lets you ram your head into different surfaces to, you know, rattle them and knock things over.
I will say I love the Pegasus boots as well. It's one of my favorite things in these 2D Zelda games especially, but like this iteration of it where it's like you have to actually have them equipped to use them is like a little bit of a bummer, you know what I mean?
Oh, so like if you had like a separate screen for like equipment rather than tools?
Yeah, exactly. Like if I could just hold the button and you're just using them.
That makes sense to me, except for like there's only so many buttons this game gives you.
That's why I'm complaining about it. So they force you to map one of your two hands to the boot, right? So Link puts the boot on his hand and begins to charge. Then it's just like you have one free spot then for a weapon as opposed to just having this active.
Well, here's the thing. Like if right after getting these boots, you can actually go straight back to Swiftblade to learn a new move that lets you dash and hold your sword out at the same time.
Yes, which great. Okay, this is a thing that you could do in other Zelda games, but in other Zelda games, anytime you use the Pegasus boots, you have the sword out, whereas in this game, you need to specifically have the equipped combination of Pegasus boots and sword.
Oh, well, it's true in multiple games, because like I haven't told you this yet, Chris. I'm actually playing Link's Awakening for the first time, the OG on the Game Boy.
Nice.
And the Pegasus boots feature there, and that works the same way.
Yeah.
Like, if you are holding your sword and the boots at the same time, then you hold it out in front of you. You don't have to learn it from a brain parasite first.
Totally. But I think just my one criticism is, like, in Link to the Past, you don't have to have them equipped. It just happens when you use the boots.
Okay.
And it's just, like, in this game where you're already spending a lot of... And Link's Awakening, I have this criticism with as well. When you're spending already a lot of time going into the pause screen to switch items into your active spots, it just leads to a lot of, you know...
It's redundant.
Slow down. That being said, Pegasus boots are always cool, always fun, and that is absolutely the exception as well in this game.
Yeah.
Anyway, before we head to the Caster Wilds, maybe we should just talk really quick about one or two other Swiftblade instances that are now available.
Oh.
We can also learn Rockbreaker from Swiftblade at this point.
Yep, which is more useful than we really have time for me to describe. Because, like, you couldn't break pots up till now.
Yes, and it's great to be able to break them. It's another one of, like, I kind of wish that I was able to when I initially...
Yeah, like...
Like, because it's just hitting the sword against the pot now breaks pots or boulders.
So now if you had started and it was just little pots you could break but not rocks, that would have been fine.
Sure. And you needed like a power glove for boulders or something.
I guess.
You know, like, I get putting that behind an item. It just seems weird not to be able to break pots, but whatever. It's not a big deal.
Maybe he's just teaching you to have looser morals.
Maybe. You can also find the Swiftblade brother Greyblade in Mount Krennel at this point. He teaches you the roll attack. The one thing I have about him is at this point, if you see him, he says, "Believe not what others tell you. I am the great swordsman Greyblade." And it's like, first of all, dude, no one's talking about you. But second of all, I think this just leads back to my original theory of all of the Blade brothers have some petty thing going on where they're all talking about each other and banishing each other.
I really don't think that these brothers can banish each other, quote unquote, like from what kingdom? They have no authority. But I will tack on to your theory that, like, rather than sending each other places, they're just a bunch of...
Oh, yeah.
They're just a bunch of jerks who, you know, they can't stand to be around each other. Because some families are like that, where they're at each other's throat all the time. Thanksgiving's a nightmare with the Swiftblade family. Definitely don't bring up their politics or anything like that. It is just, it's a bloodbath each year.
You're absolutely right. There's big Thanksgiving Day energy every day with the Blade family.
Yeah. And also, was the line you just said that, like, don't believe, don't believe what you hear, I'm Greyblade?
Yes. Well, he says, I am the great swordsman, Greyblade.
Don't believe what you hear, I'm me?
Exactly.
I'm wondering what word of mouth he thinks we've caught.
I do not know. Anyway, I think that wraps up pretty much everything before we start making our way to Caster Wilds. Did you have anything else you wanted to talk about with our Hyrule business highlight?
Nah. I think this stopover at Rem's shoe shop is kind of neat. You know, it fills in the trope of, you know, borrower type characters and such. And, like, you get a cool item, like a key tool in this game without having to go to a dungeon for it, which is neat.
Absolutely. But that's about it. There's also like an upper, but there, I think there's also an upper section to Rem's place that you can enter.
Here? I'm not so sure.
Okay, delete it. I might be wrong.
You're allowed to be wrong.
Delete it.
You're allowed to be wrong on the show, Chris.
If anyone ever hears that I said that, I swear to God. All right. So with that out of the way, we are going to make our way over to the Caster Wilds.
Caster Wilds, beautiful Caster Wilds, aka Tabanta Wilderness, aka Tabanta Marsh, aka the secret world of Tabanta, aka the unexplored Tabanta region.
Is this like some more other language stuff that you looked up?
These are all the other regions, yeah.
Okay.
Except for Italy, Chris.
Why? What's it in Italy?
Because Caster Wilds, first off, Chris, it's a hat word, okay? Similar to, you know, Trilby Highlands and such, which I'll get to that in a second.
Love consistency.
In Italy, Castor Wilde is called Busby Marsh.
Ooh.
Do you know what a Busby is, Chris?
No. What's a Busby?
Do I see you looking it up right now? A busby is that tall fur cap worn by traditional British military, like you see them standing outside of Buckingham.
I love it.
Italy, again, one of the only teams out there that understood the assignment, Chris.
Absolutely.
This is the hat game.
I feel like I would like to see if anyone, okay, if we have any artists out there, can someone draw a busby hat on top of an Armos from the Minish Cap?
An Armos?
I'd like to see it. Yeah, the Armos that we're going to meet later in this episode.
Yeah, no, that could work. Although I think possibly it'd look better on an Igor statue, because it would be like a tiny little thing on their big old heads.
Both good choices. I would love to see either of those in art form.
In any case, Castor Wilds. The word caster meaning one of two things. Either a style of hat similar to a fedora, turns out, or a hat made from beaver fur, which, given the sludgy swamp setting, I could go either way.
I genuinely, like, I know this has been the theme of the game. I genuinely didn't know caster was a type of a hat.
Neither did I. I looked it up.
That's awesome. Good research.
Good Google. Good 2-second Google.
Hey, that's some good Googling.
But by the way, Chris, unlike Trilby Valley and Trilby Plain and Breath of the Wild, the hat names for the swamp were dropped in favor of the original name for Breath of the Wild. There's no caster anything in Breath of the Wild, okay?
Right.
They just went with the original name, Tabanta, which was updated to Tabantha Frontier. Does that sound familiar to you?
Kind of, yeah.
It's the less frozen areas of the Hebra region in Breath of the Wild, like where the Rito live.
Wow.
Crazy, right?
Okay.
Which is more or less the correct portion of the map.
Isn't it sort of northwest in...
Yeah, but things all kind of shift around, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's kind of west here, right?
It's like westy, northwesty, north by northwest.
Wow.
West by northwest.
Okay, you've covered a full quarter of the map with that, but that's awesome. I love that.
And it's interesting because, like, I thought at first, once I found that out, I had a little bit of a freak out. It's like, this, so much has to have changed, right? For that to be turned like this frozen waste place. But Tabantha is actually like the less frozen area. You get like one or two cold spots, like where the water will hurt you, but you actually find like one or two spots that still have swampy water, which fits in here.
Wow. So they kind of want the extra mile.
Yeah, isn't that neat?
Oh, I love it. Oh, man, we started off the episode excited about Breath of the Wild, and it's only been building up throughout the episode.
Heck yeah, man.
Okay, so why don't we start with like a quick description of the Castor Wilds?
Okay, sure. So first thing that you're going to notice is, well, actually, the music. I don't know if that counts up to your question, Chris.
I have a note here saying that as well.
This is another solid cover of the Heroes theme.
This might be my favorite music in the game. This is at least one of my top three tracks. It just rules.
Honestly, yeah. And I mean, it has to be because this is a very large map. Like, you're going to be in this for a bit, and it's a little, like, easy to get turned around.
Mm-hmm. It's got some very Eastern... The music has some very, like, Eastern inspiration to it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I kind of have, like, it feels like Arabian to some extent. It's got, like, a flute version of the overworld theme with a lot of fun little percussion. Yeah, it's good stuff.
As far as physical traits of this place, it is very much a classic swamp. Except for the fact that it appears to have been abandoned. They've got like some well-defended wooden bridges going from like platform to platform out here. Clearly, whoever used to live here is long gone. Otherwise, you'd find more traces of them.
Yeah, that wooden bridge also is like weirdly spiky.
Yeah, it's kind of like they wanted to defend against stuff.
Yeah, I guess so. Maybe it just looks weird because it's 2D and it's kind of hard to convey.
Oh, especially because all the bridges are diagonal and your controls are not suited to that, Chris.
Right. Yeah, there are bridges connecting these like four or five different plateaus that kind of circle around the area.
Right.
That you can kind of use to get around quickly if you are higher up.
Yeah, and everything is covered in like puddles and like wetland, marshland, lots of grasses, lots of fiddleheads too. Would you know what fiddleheads are?
No.
Fiddleheads are like these very seasonal... Well, at least around here, they're these very seasonal plants that like curl up into like a little like violin top shape.
Interesting.
And people, I live in the frozen wasteland that is Maine, and people out here go absolutely ape for fiddleheads. And I don't get that, Chris.
Fiddle me this.
That's your contribution, okay?
I was hoping that I would have an actual good thing to say by the time I finished that statement, but then I just kind of hung on that.
But listen, not being a native Mainer, I do not understand the attraction for fiddleheads. I won't yuck anyone's yum, though, but I will say, to me, they taste like nothing. I don't know what the like the whole deal is with fiddleheads.
Fiddleheads, rise up. Find Pete at the edge of my Pete on Twitter and just harass him nonstop about fiddleheads.
Or just explain to me how they're good, because I don't understand it personally. In any case, the other defining feature here is the water. You got two different varieties here. Clear blue water that you will sink in, and sludgy, darker, thicker swamp water that you can run on top of with the Pegasus boots. Mm-hmm. Apart from that, there's going to be a couple different little corners where you find like vines you can climb up, or you can find like
some hollowed out wooden tree trunks that are fallen that obviously you can get through in minish form.
You can crawl through them if there's a hole for you there, or you can push a rock into a pachi hole so that you can just walk through it normally.
There are some small sections of like very colorful flowers, but this is largely green and blue.
Yeah.
Like most of this section.
Yeah.
And it is filled to the brim with some new enemies. You want to start talking about these enemies?
I wouldn't say it's filled to the brim with new enemies, because it's mostly ones we've seen.
Yeah, that's fair. It's filled to the brim with enemies, period.
So first up, we've got a longtime member of enemy rosters in this franchise. Like-likes. Standard like-likes.
Finally.
They're not the ruby likes that confuse you so much, Chris.
These are the Cheerio like-likes.
I still don't see it, but I'm willing to give you some leeway there.
They're like chocolate Cheerios. Anyway, next up is...
Well, real quick. I do want to talk about like-likes for a minute, just in general. Because I want to talk about just how strange these creatures are as far as like organic creature biology is, right? Because I'm pretty sure these are not a malice monster. This is just like a strange animal monster that exists in the world. They're clearly some kind of boneless bug or some kind, right? Like a goopy leech.
There are no bones in that thing.
Not at all. They can bury themselves in the dirt or sand to hide from prey. You know, standard predator animal tactic.
Mm-hmm.
In some games, they can be found living in salt water. Like, they can actually exist underwater. So, like, I get the impression these are, like, aquatic-born creatures. They're very, like, protozoan, I think.
I could see that. I could see this being, like, an amoeba.
Yeah, kind of, a little bit. Like, they just started evolving.
Or, like, a sea anemone. Just, like, something just, like, kind of swaying on the bottom of the ocean floor.
Yeah, like, they're even harder to discern underwater. And also, they most notoriously eat metal.
Oh, yeah, because these things are always chomping away at your shield.
Yeah, they will grab it from you and spit you out, actually. Like, the metal is what they're after.
That's weird. Like, I wonder if they just slowly rust away the metal and then consume whatever kind of comes from that.
I have to, yeah, I do have to assume the digestion is slow in these, especially in this game, because, like, there are some games where when a like-like steals your shield, it's just gone. You got to go buy a new one. In this game, you can actually kill it and get it back.
Right, which is so much better. Never make me go back to a store to get a thing. Please.
Yeah, I have to agree with that, honestly. It's kind of a bummer. You know what, though? Like, I just feel like-likes like-likes could survive nuclear fallout, right? Like, they're that kind of, like, weird alien resilient creature.
Oh, yeah. This is definitely something that would survive in the apocalypse. I'm with you.
But anyway, I just wanted to ruminate on that for a minute. I think like-likes are interesting, but they are just buck wild weird.
You know what I think is interesting?
What at?
Igor.
Igor statues.
Yeah.
Yeah. In most Zelda games where they show up, Igors are statues already. Like, they work basically the same way. For some reason, Minish Cap felt the need to differentiate that they are statues.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know why they feel like they need to make that distinction here. But I guess it's like less lifelike in this. Like, it is more clearly defined as a statue than in some other games.
Just straightforward gray stone here. Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. If you look at the one at in Majora's Mask, by the way, Chris, It is a hot nightmare. It looks nothing like this.
I forgot. The one that comes to mind to me is the Link to the Past one, which is very much a statue as well.
Yeah, more or less.
But I mean, these things, you fight them the way you fight Igors in any of these games, right? It's a bow and arrow to the eye, or it's an arrow to the eye. The bow stays in your hands in an ideal situation.
More than one, actually, because you have to use one arrow to wake it up in the first place.
A lot of weird sleepers in this episode.
That's a good point. We're going to hit another one in a minute too, which, yeah, I got some stuff to think about there.
Let's keep going because I'm excited to talk about that one.
Now, here's one more thing about Igor statues, by the way. Something that popped up in the figurine description, which I won't quote here, but it suggests that like you can wake it up and just move on by, which I didn't think about at all.
I don't think that's a thing. They like circle around, don't they?
They move very slow. Like they follow you. I mean, usually encounter Igor statues blocking a path.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so like if you wake it up and you kite it somewhere, you can just leave it.
Yeah, you don't have to waste the arrows.
Yeah, I have killed every Igor statue I have come across. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, and I guess that could become a little bit of a slow, tedious process to some extent. I mean, you can kind of just unload into them once they're coming at you.
Gross.
Who else do we have here?
For creatures that are not new, we got pea hats, those yummy little eggplants. We got blue muldozers, which I don't think we've seen them until now.
We've seen muldozers.
For sure. These are the ones that have even greater like bumper car energy.
They absolutely do. And this is another instance of like, they're not a mini boss, but it's like you kill six of a very standard enemy and you're going to get a cool reward for it.
For sure.
It just reminded me of, what was it in the other episode? It was like choo-choo. It was like a bunch of choo-choo.
It was
or
like
something.
Eight spiny choo-choo.
Yeah. Anyway, let's keep going.
The other not new creature, which I'm not sure it counts as an enemy, but business scrubs return in this area.
Yeah, their allegiance is never very clear. They are a friend one day and a foe the next.
They're capitalists.
Next up, we have kind of an interestingly named fellow called a rope.
Yes, I still don't understand. I know these, like, all these monsters were named in the NES era, but, like, what's a strange thing we can call this snake? I don't know. It's long. What's another long thing? A rope? It's a rope now. Okay, moving on.
I like the idea, though, of, like, this is kind of like our time, but it's not exactly like our time. And maybe...
How do you mean?
I mean, like, it's not... I like the idea that this is, like, a fantasy world, but, like, language isn't locked down exactly the same way that it's locked down in the real world. Uh-huh. So they could see something like a snake and be like, whoa, what is that? Well, we have to name it something. And like, they have a rope. Like, they have ropes in this world. So they're like, I don't know. I guess it's like a rope. We could just call it a rope.
I suppose it could also like be the reverse, right? If we're going down that road, kind of like how there's, you know, people like myself who believe in the Pokemon universe, like the names of the Pokemon came first and then language came later.
That's an interesting idea.
I mean, if you think about it, if you grow up, I mean, if you evolve around these things, then like,
okay, so these things are saying their names before language, like predating language
in Pokemon. Yeah, I'm thinking in the world of Hyrule, I'm thinking possibly like they started to call these snakes ropes and then we invented ropes.
Do you think that they made ropes out of these snakes when they finally did?
You know what, that's a possibility.
I don't like that at all.
I think it's kind of metal, actually.
That is kind of cool. Anyway, next up.
Well, I mean, if we should probably just really quickly actually describe, because they are snakes. They're like little green garden snakes with an evil cartoon face. Not a huge threat, but more annoying than you'd expect if you're trying to get through here quickly.
And if you are doing Kinstone stuff, you might see a golden rope in here at some point later in the game.
Yeah, which we've addressed golden mobs before.
Absolutely. Another enemy here is the scissors beetle.
Oh, my greatest nightmare. Great, cool.
Yeah. Someone looked at the disgusting bug, a beetle, and said, what can we do to make this worse? Let's put a weapon on the front of them.
I would say, first off, I don't see much of a beetle in this thing. This looks like an antlion to me. with like huge mandibles.
That's a fair observation.
Okay, so imagine a huge yellow ant with massive blue front mandibles that it can throw at you like a boomerang.
I love it.
Chef kiss. Awful. I hate it.
When they throw those boomerang mandibles at you, you go in and strike its then vulnerable face to take it out. I don't think we actually see any on this pass through. I think this is when we come back later, isn't it? Don't we have to get into the caves first?
I mean, these show up when you're small. There's a corner in the upper left in the northwest quadrant of this map where you actually have to jump in to get the bow. It's something around that area where you encounter these the first time, I think.
Cool. I think there's really just one more guy to talk about here. It's Darknut. Listen, this series needs like a standard knight enemy, like heroic knight enemy.
Oh, yeah.
And I think Darknuts are pretty consistently good for that role.
I think, okay, so they are big old shadow knights, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like this, I mean, the first one you encounter has got silver armor, very standard for like medieval knights.
I made a note that I think for some reason I saw it was called a Guardian Darknut. And it kind of reminded me of the Guardians in the Silent Realm of Skyward Sword.
Did they?
A little bit. It's got that white armor with like a big weapon.
Well, you encounter one with white armor later in the game, I think. This one's more like a, you know, your standard medieval times knight. Like big armor, big sword, big shield, hard to get around. Like you got to get around them to hit them. The design is derived from Wind Waker, like so many other things in this game are.
Mm-hmm.
However, their armor does not come off in this. So like we don't know if they have like those adorable Doberman pincher heads this time.
Oh.
Remember? They had like little dog heads when you knocked their armor off.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that. Yeah. No, yeah, these are, I do think these are kind of fun to fight though. Like the tactic you use in this game, or one of the two you can use, is like charging through them with the Pegasus boots, which I've got to imagine has Link slide underneath their legs and pop up behind them and then just stab them in their weak point. I kind of like that idea.
I mean, it works more like that in a 3D game, but in 2D, it doesn't quite...
it doesn't quite look as cool.
You got to leave some of it to the imagination, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Any other enemies or anything else you want to talk about with the enemies?
No, I think that's more or less it. Like, Darknuts in particular are kind of tough in this game. Like, I'm pretty sure there's probably some kind of trick or cool, like, skill you could use to get around them. Or you can fight them like I do and just run like mad and like flail and try to hit them all you can. I kind of miss the Darknuts of other games where, like, the other 2D games where you can kind of take advantage of the perspective and just smack them on the head.
Sure. With this one, I think that they like make a little ting sound that if you strike them immediately after, it'll hit them.
Mm-hmm.
I have a note about that. But yeah, I hear you. It's not like really as clear cut as in some of the 3D games. All right. So now that we've talked about some of the actual enemy types that we encounter in the Caster Wilds, why don't we talk about how we get through the Caster Wilds itself?
It's pretty straightforward, isn't it?
A little. So you have to use the Pegasus boots to run through this water.
Every which way.
And a lot of it is using the Pegasus boots, turning, using the boots again immediately. Like,
it's kind of weird.
There's like that moment of levitation.
Like Looney Tunes stuff.
Yeah.
When
you're
totally. Like, you run off a cliff and you don't fall until you look down, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's like a mini, there's like a few rooms in here that lead to a Guardian Darknut who,
yeah,
it's basically like a mimic Darknut in some regard.
A mimic? How do you mean?
There's a treasure chest in the room that when you open it, the Darknut appears.
Oh, it's like a trap. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a trap. But it just leads to a Darknut fight. You take him down. As we discussed a minute ago, you could do dashes through him. You could just do regular sword swipes. And then when you beat him, you get a golden kinstone piece.
The first of three, I think.
The first of three in this area, but I think you get golden kinstone pieces across the game. And it generally just means this is a story kinstone piece.
Yeah, more or less. So you open this chest and the Darknut appears, yes?
Yes.
Similar to the start of the game.
Where, okay, I guess, where the chest got cracked open and all of the enemies.
Yeah, like it doesn't necessarily have to be that, but like, could you, like, the story writer in me latched onto the idea real quick there. Like, what if this is, you know, a separate, like, important Darknut that they left here for this reason?
That they left here for what reason, though?
To, you know, protect this kinstone piece.
But there are three Darknuts. Oh, no, there aren't. aren't three dark nuts with each Kinstone piece.
Right.
There's just this one.
This is the only one that's protected, as far as I'm aware.
Okay, so they leave him here to protect this one piece. Who leaves him here, and what are they guarding?
Well,
like, you think this is Vati creating enemies again?
Could be. I'm not sure. It's possible that, like, they... I'm wildly inventing here, Chris, but, like, possibly, like, they had this one dark nut trapped here already, and they decided to make use of it as, like, a, you know, a security system?
I guess so.
As for the Who, we find out who lived here in a little bit.
Yes, that's true. That's a very fun reveal.
Anyhow, the other two Kinstone pieces, you find one of them in a cave to the north, basically unprotected.
Uh-huh. It's behind an Igor.
Behind an Igor, sure. But, like, as we discussed before, you can basically just, you know, juke them once they're awake.
If you have the bow and arrow.
Which we'll talk about in a second, because I have some questions.
And the third Kinstone piece is in the southeast. Essentially, you are on one of those plateaus, I guess I'll call them, and you ride a cyclone over some water and enter a cave in the south, and it's just in a blue treasure chest.
Yeah. It's a little odd, because, like, I mean, this place is so old that, like, putting together, like, the history of it is very, very difficult, right? Like, in world, you'd need a team of archaeologists to try and figure out the exact meaning behind these things.
I think there's more to the next area in some regards, but yeah, right. I mean, this is just a whole big marsh, a swampy...
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Moisture will do that to history. Just kind of erode everything. So, like, we're doing the best we can.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we'll get to what these are used for in just a second. I want to backtrack really quick, because we've mentioned a couple times that you get the bow here, because, you know, you need it for the Igors, etc. You get the bow in this little, like, hidden hole in the northeast corner of Caster Wilds. In the northwest corner of Caster Wilds. You have to shrink down in a tree stump and ride a couple lily pads to get to it, because it's on this, like, little forgotten little corner.
Love the little lily pad riding sections. This one has, like, some big flowers in the way in the water that you have to avoid.
Oh, yes. You're thinking about in the one where you have like a little Minish road, like a separate map.
Mm-hmm.
This one for the bow is actually, like, just straight up on the map here. Like, it's almost nondescript for how out of the way it is. Where you just drop into this little hole, you fight some Muldozers.
Five Muldozers.
And that triggers, you know, the life sensor alarm, you know, that the life sensor trigger that so many Zelda dungeons have. You know, you beat the monsters and the door opens.
Yep.
But this makes a chest appear that has the bow in it.
Mm-hmm.
What is this?
I gotta say, I was glad for it to just be so easy to get one. Like, it's not like, oh, you have to save up a bunch of rupees.
For sure.
Oh, it's not hidden away in some dungeon. You kind of just get one here.
Absolutely. Like, I really dig how, like, back to back we got two major pieces of equipment, both outside of a dungeon.
Yeah.
That, like, is breaking convention pretty hard. Although, it just now made me realize, like, is this why there's so few dungeons? Is this related to that?
No. I mean, they probably had the limitation of how many dungeons they could create and then figured, okay, well, we want these to be the items in those dungeons.
Uh-huh.
And these are the items that don't fit that, or maybe we don't want to block the progression that is needed from these items, so we'll just put them in the world.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Then again, when you think about the next dungeon, the item you get, it's not exactly exciting, so having two other items to play with is also very good.
Yeah, I'm kind of torn. I kind of like... we'll get to the next item
we'll get to it. But Chris, why do you find, like, the bow of all things? Is this just, like, a bow, or is it the bow? Because, like, in so many other Zelda games, you get the bow and it's like the hero's bow, the goddess bow, the super important bow that somebody left behind for you.
There's nothing remarkable about this bow. I think eventually you get light arrows in this game, right?
Yeah, you do. It's I'm not sure the capacity in which you have that ability, but
the bow itself doesn't shift at that point.
I don't think so.
It's just a bow. Yeah, no, this is just a standard hero's bow.
And it's just hidden in this chest in some long-forgotten hole. And it's Minish-sized.
And it's Minish-shot. That's the ticket.
What's up?
Yeah.
What's going on in Minish history?
And we're just making it a big boy bow that we use for the rest of the journey. It's kind of like how we get the little shield. And that's our only shield throughout this whole game until the very end.
Until the very end. Wink, wink.
But yeah, I don't know. That's a cool little thing I didn't think about until this very moment.
I could write five different, I could write five different fanfics about this right now, but we don't have time for that.
Before we move on, I have in my notes from when I actually played this that I enjoyed the design of the woods and the progression you make along it. I think it helps that this is kind of a short section to get through.
Short-ish.
Yeah, and like you can kind of see most of the map and it's just like easy to remember where everything is.
Yeah.
Also great music.
Great music. I mean, you're going to come back here a lot, so I hope you do like the music. Like a lot of Kinstone stuff opens up this area more, and also stuff that requires items you don't have yet.
Yeah, there are some caves with mud blocking the entrance that we're going to come back for.
For example, yeah.
So anyway, we get those three gold Kinstone pieces, and we head to the southwest corner of the map, where there are these three big statue heads again.
Yeah, these big old Olmec heads.
Yeah, I feel like we keep talking about big statues that are heads, or honestly, after last episode, just statues of any size that are heads.
Yeah, you had a real, like, existential crisis about those Goron statue heads, huh?
I still think it's weird. Anyway, we give the Kinstone, we merge Kinstone, not really merge, I guess merge.
Yeah, we perform Kinstone fusion with them.
Yeah, and they start doing these thwomp stomps.
I guess that's one way to put it. Yeah, they individually, each of them, when you fuse with them, they perform a quake.
Yeah.
When they flip upside down and look happy.
And this breaks a rock blocking the exit to the southwest exit of this map.
Chris, was this intended?
I don't know, man.
It's such a strange... I don't have many theories about this particular portion, but like, isn't it? It's just a little weird.
I mean, this could be there was a tribe in this area, right? That might have very well blocked off that exit because that leads to where the tribe occupied.
Okay.
So maybe it was a protection thing of some sort.
They had to have been pretty smart though to plant a huge boulder in the path there, but then also plant three Olmecs that are specifically strong enough to quake and destroy it.
I hear you, but then they had to be pretty stupid to just put the Kinstones in the immediate vicinity.
One guarded by a dark nut.
Okay, yeah, I guess. Anyway, do you have anything else about this area before we move on to the next one?
Just two quick things. One, I find it immensely interesting that this is the future home of the Rito.
It's cool.
Right?
I don't know. I'm still kind of like processing that because you told me earlier this episode. It's cool considering who lived right nearby in this game.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. It's like it attracts species that, you know, have an affinity for the sky. I think that's pretty cool.
I think that's very cool. I'm glad you mentioned that because right over my head.
Yeah. Honestly, if you don't pay attention to the names of stuff, then like a lot of that's gonna pass you by. The only other note that I have is that if you are ever running low on green Kinstone pieces, come here and break grass and fiddleheads to your heart's delight. You will have to make return trips so that you're not weighed down by the amount of green Kinstone pieces in your pockets, Chris. There's so many.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly which Kinstones are in which areas, but that's good to know. That's definitely good to know. I mean, there may come a time where you need to farm those things.
In any case, once you bust this boulder open, you can march on down into the Valley of the Wind Ruins. I just realized I took on a little bit of Legends of the Hidden Temple tone there.
Now you gotta edit your voice to make you sound like Olmec.
The Shrine of the Silver Monkey.
All right, it's cheating if you just do the voice.
I mean, I don't know. Is that cheating?
So the Wind Ruins, what is there to say? Do you want to go description first and then enemies, or?
Well, it's significantly less wet. That's the first thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is less wet.
It's just like a canyon type area. It's boxed in by, you know, cliff walls and such. More killer music, by the way.
Yes.
This might be one of my favorites.
I'm jealous. Your episode had two good location-based musics.
Well, feel free to listen to the episode when it comes out.
Yeah, this is basically just a valley kind of leading into the next dungeon. It's very enclosed. Mm-hmm. You're basically kind of going in a straight line and then in a straight line in another direction and then a straight line in another direction. fashion.
Very linear. It's packed with these old stone ruins that have been overgrown with, like, you know, greenery and such. Clearly been abandoned for a long time.
Yeah, the theme of this place is rocks.
Well, the theme of this place is wind, Chris.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah, no, I think it's around when you pop in that Ezlo will tell you that, like, this place was once occupied by the Wind Tribe.
The Wind Tribe? Ooh, that's mysterious.
The mysterious Wind Tribe. You hear that name after playing Skyward Sword, you could probably already have, like, at least two theories on your hands.
Ooh, that is fun. Okay, we can't talk about that now. We will have a full episode. We can unpack that.
For sure, for sure.
Let's talk about some of the inhabitants here.
Inhabitants being monsters.
They're monsters to you?
What? Where are you going with this?
I don't know. So there are Tektites. We've talked about Tektites. There's really not much more to say about Tektites.
Tektites.
I once again wrote Tektites.
They're the little tiny baby Tektites. They're little Tektites.
Oh, wait, is that really the thing?
No.
Oh, you had me fooled.
But yeah, no, you got the red Tektites, you got ropes again, you got spiny beetles again. The two new enemies in here, one, you got levers. As in go away, I guess. They're levers. But if you look at them, these are in a bunch of different Zelda games, and I think they look basically the same in every game they show up in, even the 3D ones. They're like these
terrifying ground mouths.
Do they have mouths? I just see them as like little, like, toothy diglet bugs.
They're mostly mouths. They have little pincers. They're just all mouth.
Oh, I guess that could be counted. I just thought they were like little, like, mincers that, like, blend things up because they spin wherever they go.
Oh, you know what? Okay, I think you could be right there.
And, like, they are mostly featureless except for the teeth, and they will, you know, duck down and burrow in the ground. Probably the spinning plays a part in that too. And they'll pop up in random spots. They're kind of annoying, Chris.
Kind of annoying. That's fitting.
Red levers, pretty standard. Blue ones are a tiny bit stronger, which, you know, is often the case in Zelda games. But here's a thing that I didn't know, Chris. If you block a lever with your shield, they immediately return underground without a fight.
Oh.
You do have to kill them eventually, but, you know, if you want them to leave a spot, you can hit them with a shield.
So it's almost antithetical to the like-likes that we saw in the previous screen, where as you want to have your shield out when you see these guys.
I guess. I mean, if your goal is to destroy them, though, the shield is just going to prolong things.
Sure, fair enough.
But we're not here to talk about levers, Chris, right? We're just being honest with each other.
No way.
We're not here for the levers.
No way. I'm here for the stayer.
You here for the stayer?
The armos. Because they stay in place until you activate them.
Oh, boy. Somehow my own bad joke became less funny.
It's very late. We've both had very long days. So I think that joke was perfectly acceptable.
Armos, another long-standing enemy in the Zelda franchise. Typically, we ran into some in Skyward Sword, although those were more like the corporate security drones.
I really liked those armos.
These ones are more the standard type, where they are, you know, just static statues that you find standing around. But if you run into them or, you know, harass them in any way, then they will come to life and attack.
Yep. These were built by the Minish for the Wind Tribe long ago.
Apparently. Yeah. One Minish in this area will tell you that.
Yeah. And also the figurine description.
I find that kind of interesting. Does that mean, like, they played a part in Skyward Sword too?
Why would they have played a part in Skyward Sword?
Because I'm just curious, because, you know, there's armos in that game. Did they also play a part in making those armos?
You mean, well, this would be technically after that in the timeline, though, right? Like, so these could have been built, like, with the knowledge of those, like, those were built previously.
Right.
These could have been built, like, oh, we have seen these, we are aware of these.
Uh-huh.
Like, let us build these for you, because these are security mechanisms.
Right. Here, we saw these over in Lanayru. Here's a smaller, kind of dumpier lobster-looking one.
They kind of look like ripped pigmen with astronaut helmets.
You think they look ripped, huh?
Like, not like ripped by ripped standards, but ripped by pigmen standards.
I guess
there's a very specific type of physique that this franchise gives pigmen, and this is not it.
This, I mean, you look at Moblins in this game, though, they're kind of, those guys are kind of ripped.
Okay, fair enough.
No, and honestly, I see Bugman or Lobster Man with these things. The design is a little weird.
They have these like pink ears.
Yeah.
And they have these circular white faces. I mean, it's really not a face. There's no facial features. It's like a screen to look out of.
Yeah, yeah. Which, I mean, some of these you don't see that on, actually, which turns out the Armos can be turned on or off. At least this model can.
Yeah, yeah. So this is a cool little twist to the Armos in this game.
Yeah, this is like the whole mechanic of the Wind Ruins.
Yeah. Menish Link can climb into the inactive Armos and trigger it to become active. And why would you want to do that, you might be thinking? Well, probably because there is a puzzle in which the Armos needs to be moved or killed in order to, you know, make way for Link or maybe create a treasure chest or whatever.
Or you can turn them off to keep them from immediately running into your intended path.
Yeah, that's a fun little twist on the formula at the end of this.
Chris, turning small to crawl inside the brain of a robot to turn it on or off, this rules.
I really like that twist on the Armos. Yeah.
This is one of the coolest parts of the game, from in my opinion. Like, the only thing that would have made it cooler would be like if they'd let you pilot one.
That's, there it is. That's the ticket.
A little Minish Jaeger. That would have been pretty sweet.
So yeah, I mean, if these were, you know, once built by the Minish ages ago to help humans, then what went wrong here?
You mean in the Wind Ruins in particular?
Yeah, like, why are these things now hostile? I mean, they're inactive, but when active, why did they become hostile?
I mean, I have to assume their job is to defend the Wind Ruins, but when the Wind Tribe dipped, they left these guys behind.
Right. So you think that they see Link and they're like, oh, we need to protect the tribe from...
Oh, yeah, big time. They don't know you.
Okay, I think that's acceptable.
Especially when you think how the Wind Tribe has a very specific look that you do not have.
Mm-hmm. I mean, unfortunately for the Wind Tribe, these dudes just kind of go down with four sword swings once they're activated.
Yeah, they don't do a great job. They're kind... I mean, they're old and dilapidated, though. Who knows? They could have been, like, doing Kung Fu back in their original day.
That's true. That's true. So yeah, we're just kind of going through these ruins at this point. Like, is there anything remarkable that you wanted to talk about in Wind Ruins?
I mean, not really. Everything that I wanted to say have already been mentioned. There's a few different spots where, Minish have little hidey holes in that you can turn tiny and run into. I counted at least three when I played.
Yeah, there are some fun little, like, if you double back on some areas, you can find, like, a hidden vine that'll, if your Minish size will get you into a little cavern and get a treasure chest.
Yeah.
A few little things like that.
You know, between this place and Caster Wilds, you probably want to make your return trip to these areas closer to the end of the game once everything has been unlocked.
Oh, yeah.
Because otherwise, you're going to be making a lot of return trips.
I mean, Kinstone Fusions are also going to really open this place up a little bit and present some new things in here. So I agree with that.
In any case, I think I'm good with this area. Do we want to, like, real quick to give our travel recommendations?
Yeah, some T-Rex.
No, please. Genuinely, I hate it.
All right, so we had, what was it? Best bite, best attraction.
So for our travel recommendations, we like to give our chosen photo op, our top attraction, and our favorite food that we can have around here. Really quick, I think this time we can try just like going for each category. We both give ours, and then we move to the next category.
Okay.
Okay. So what's your photo op for this area?
My photo op will probably be getting into an Armos Minish size and taking a picture with your face coming out of its face.
Oh, that's good.
You know, like how people will put their head in those like cardboard stands where there's like room for a face.
You might need someone's help with that.
Yeah, maybe. But it's basically that for Link.
I dig that, honestly. Especially if you have the picture taken far enough away and you show someone the photo just to surprise them.
There you go.
It's like, I don't see you in this picture. I don't understand what you're trying to...
Or you blow it up, make it life-size, and then put it in someone's room as they sleep, and then they wake up and there's just a giant Armos with your face in their room.
We're talking about something entirely different now. But my recommended photo op is taking a selfie with the smiling Olmecs at the end of Caster Wilds.
That's a good pick. I didn't even think about that.
Honestly, it's pretty good. Good vibes around there.
Yeah, they're nice.
What's your top attraction?
My top attraction would be the Igor Bow Range, which is basically a bow and arrow range of Igor statues in the distance. I mean, like, essentially half of this map is you shooting arrows at Igors, right? So it's just a makeshift.
Okay, so you want to set up, like, this is a new attraction that you want to set up.
I feel like we're kind of doing that with the best attractions this season of, like, yeah, manipulating a little bit, right? So I think
I dig it.
Have a range with Igors different distances away and just have it as a shooting range.
Right on. Yeah, that could work. I mean, if you're able to, like, restrain them enough to where they won't attack you.
Oh, yeah, I kind of forgot that they're sentient beings there, and that's actually a very cruel thing to do to something, huh?
If they are, I mean, they're more robotic than anything in this game, so possibly it's kosher.
Yeah, their name says statue, so I'm going with it.
Go with it. My recommended attraction for these locations is running on water, dog. Apparently, like, Pegasus boots are a dime a dozen out here in this era of Hyrule. So, like, just have a stall nearby handing out Pegasus boots and let people run on the water.
Yeah. I mean, there is a merchant right nearby that sells the boots to do this. So you're right. It just seems so much more commonplace in this game than it does in some other games.
It's kind of cool. Like, it kind of lends to, like, the, you know, a more magical era that people are living in. So what is your recommended food item here in the Caster Wilds?
I'm cheating, but mine is Syrup's Mushroom because there's nothing in Caster Wilds I want to eat. It's a swamp. I don't want to eat any of this.
You know, I find that incredibly funny for two reasons. One being, you are a coffee addict, so a wake-up mushroom is very your vibe.
Yep. Fair point.
The second thing is, I mentioned fiddleheads in this, which is something that people actually eat in the real world, and you avoided that, which I personally appreciate.
I just remembered, though, how stinky the mushroom is, so I kind of regret my choice, but gotta keep pushing forward.
You made this choice, now you gotta stick with it. My personal choice for food in this episode is ropes. It's just a snake. That's authentic swamp cuisine, my friend.
So you're just making, like, some snake spaghetti?
I mean, in the sense that there's, like, snake meat in the spaghetti, yeah.
Oh, right. You're just gonna eat it like snake meat. Never mind.
I'm not gonna slurp a snake up like a noodle.
Listen, I'm hungry and I want to eat some spaghetti right now.
That actually sounds great.
Yeah.
I love that. I got some leftover ravioli in the fridge. I might go grab one.
Nothing like some 10 p.m. Italian dinner to make you feel real good in the morning.
That's going to do it for Caster Wilds and the Wind Ruins.
Yeah, they are two pretty brief areas, but honestly, it's a pretty fun section of the game.
Pretty memorable, I think.
Music-wise, especially. So what's coming up next episode?
Next episode, we're going to be delving into the Fortress of Winds.
Oh, another dungeon. I like it.
One of my favorites. And Chris, we also may learn the final destination of the magma.
Oh.
As promised.
Now I'm on the edge of my seat because I genuinely don't know. Oh, wait. No, I kind of know what you're referring to. Very cool. Yes, I can't wait.
I got some. Next episode might be a big theory episode again. We're going to have to see.
Lucky me.
Before we wrap up, Chris, I have a quick shout out that I wanted to give.
Oh, do it.
So I wanted to give a shout out to the podcast Saturday Morning Obscurities, which I guested on a couple months ago. The episode that I guested on should be out this weekend, actually.
Hey, Pete.
What's up?
What's Saturday Morning Obscurities?
Saturday Morning Obscurities is a very cool, very chill podcast that talks about old obscure cartoons and, you know, other live action shows that you might remember from your youth. They talk about stuff like Sonic Underground or like But Ugly Martians or a little more well-known stuff like Courage the Cowardly Dog. It's really good. It's a really fun show.
Yeah.
The hosts are brother and sister, Jams and Melissa, and they are just a delight. They're very good.
I also recommend it and definitely start with Pete's episode, which will be coming out soon.
It could be out right now.
It could be. So type in Saturday Morning Obscurities into your podcast app. What are you waiting for?
In any case, that's going to be a wrap on Caster Wilds and The Wind Ruins.
That's right.
If you want to reach out to the show, you can shoot us a postcard in one of two ways. You can send us an email at HyrulePod@gmail.com, or you can drop us a rating and review over on Apple Podcasts. Ratings and reviews are what help more people like you find this show. If you want to track us down on social media, you can find us on Twitter, Insta, and Tumblr at HyrulePod. If you want to find us individually on Twitter, I am at The Edge of My Pete.
And I am at a man named Babs.
That is going to do it for Hello Hyrule. Thank you for listening. Next episode is The Fortress of Winds. Until then, I have been Pete.
I've been Chris.
Excuse me, podcast.